No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-628-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIO and the number one. It's great to be back with you. We have a special guest tonight, Dr. John West, who we'll introduce in a moment. But first, I want to talk about something that happened this week. There was legislation before the Council of the District of Columbia to fund elections in the district, to have public funding of elections, but it didn't include my office or anybody in my delegation. Our delegation, which is two senators and a representative, were the only offices left out of the bill. And I found this unconscionable, not because it would affect me at all. I'm running for re-election now, and I have a six-year term. So the legislation doesn't take effect for 2 years. It really doesn't affect me personally. But I felt that it said, once again, that our offices were meaningless, that they're not supported by the city. And it was just one more, one more opportunity for them to disparage our offices, and they took it. So we lobbied to get the bill amended. The guy who wrote the bill refused to amend it and said to me with all the pomposity of a petty potentate, if you think you can get it amended, go get it amended. And we found a guy to amend it. We found somebody on the council willing to put in an amendment. Six members of the council told me that they would support the amendment. Then at the very last minute, they have a breakfast prior to the legislative session. The chairman of the council lobbied against it, and not one person stood up for the bill. It passed unanimously the way it was, and I just think that's terrible.
So, Michael, the amendment had to be approved prior to it being introduced?
Yeah, let me explain.
I'm not quite sure how the legislation goes.
Yeah, and I didn't explain that properly. The legislation passed, and then there's a second reading of the legislation. And the idea of passing it and then waiting 2 or 3 weeks for a second reading for the final passage is that it gives the council an opportunity to ruminate over the bill and make amendments if they want to make amendments. And they actually made a couple of technical amendments. So the bill had already passed, basically, and on the second reading, if they had amended it, then they would have had to pass it again.
Of these amendments, not just the amendment that included your office.
Right. Whatever amendments were put on, they would have to pass it. And like I say, excuse me, there were a couple of technical amendments, and they passed those. But they didn't amend. They wouldn't amend our bill. And you know, the guy that put it up for amendment, one of the council members, came out after the breakfast and said, "We're not going to offer the amendment because nobody, not one person, is supporting it." You know, even though six people on the council told me they would support it, and all you need is seven votes. So six people and the guy that introduced it would have been enough votes.
So I would also suggest that ostensibly there's a delay between it being written and it being voted on so that they can go check with their constituents and yes. come back with an informed vote that isn't personal but is representative.
Yes. And, you know, it's an election year, and that was it. It would have been inconvenient for them to amend the bill because people are afraid of amendments at the last minute because they're afraid it'll derail the bill. So they had all these young people, and that was the hardest part. They had these young people that thought they were making a better democracy, and they're activists in D.C., and they weren't going to disappoint them or make them nervous during an election year. And it's horrible. A lot of those people said, yes, you should have been included. But now it's too late. How can it be too late? You know, I quoted to them Mark Twain, who said, you're never wrong to do the right thing. It would have been the right thing to do, but they didn't do it. So in the end of the story is this. I hate to be all Paul Harvey on you, but the rest of the story is this. You and I, Maria, are the only two that got that. But, you know, I stood up, and when the vote was taken, I stood up and I said, you people are cowards. You should be ashamed of yourself. And then I walked, and then the chairman of the committee threatened to have me removed from the chamber. And I walked over to all the kids that started, that all the young people that pushed it, and I said, this is not what democracy looks like. And I left. So, you know, that's the piece that made the paper, of course, that Brown interrupted the applause and stood up there with righteous indignation and said that, you know, these people are cowards. But they are. They're cowards. You know,
well, it's
also
got
to have a little guts.
Like you said, it's not democracy. So how can they hide behind that and point a finger at you?
Well, the very best part of it, Maria, is that the guy said that it was a local funding bill, so it didn't include us because we're national political people. And the truth of the matter is he voted just last year to take us out of being national political people and return our offices to local offices because – we're not allowed, when we become a state, our offices do not transcend to the Senate and to the House, as they have in every other state that's ever used this. In California, the people that were elected senators, when they became states, became United States senators. But in the District of Columbia, when we become a state, our offices are just dissolved. So to use that as an excuse, after he stabbed us in the back once, you know, it's terrible. But This is, you know, the former co-host of the show, Kathleen Gomez, who was a political advisor to me, told me 2 years ago, get out of the Wilson Building. These people will never help you with anything. And I guess that's true. They'll never help me with anything.
So. But what I find most discouraging is that you're talking about Washingtonians.
Yeah.
The very people who you need to be in harmony with. And yes. You're not. Not you.
Well,
but the
you know
system
what?
As it is.
I think that's what I have to do. I have to take the battle to the people and not depend on these petty politicians because they're not going to do it. They don't care. There's nothing in it for them. I say it all the time. There's nothing in it for the politicians in D.C. for statehood. The only thing that's in it for state, the only people that gain from statehood are everybody that lives in Washington. But
why wouldn't that elevate the city council?
You would think, but they get $14 billion one way or the other. They get $14 billion whether you call them governor or mayor or whether you call them council member or representative. They have the same power. And imagine that. There's 13 of them. They have more than $1 billion each to spend. In New Hampshire, you have 435 people and a budget of like $2 billion. They all get like $10 million in their budget. These guys get $1 billion each. They're very powerful locally.
I would say.
So okay. they don't want to switch, you know. I used to, when I ran my own business, I used to have a thing over my desk from an economist from University of Chicago that said, in the long run, we're all dead. Because that was the mantra of business. You know, we're always making the next payroll. We're always making the next, you know, next month. And you know, that's the way these guys think too. We've got it. Why share it? And you know, it's horrible. And let me tell you, I told you this before the show. The thing I'm proudest of in my life, I think, is that I did 25 years worth of business. I ran my own consulting firm. I did $17 million worth of business on a handshake. Never signed a contract. Never had a memorandum of understanding with anybody. Never got sued. Never had anybody take any kind of action against me. Because when I told you I was going to do it, I did it. And that's what I find so horrible about this. They said they were going to do it, and then they reneged. And I want to tell you,
is there recourse? Can you start a petition or?
No, I mean, I could gather signatures, but they're not going to amend it. You know, no, I just have to move on at this point. And like you say, it doesn't affect me personally. It just says that my office doesn't count. And you know, as far as they're concerned, and that's just terrible.
Wow.
But let's move on to our guest, because we have a very important guest tonight, John West. Dr. West is a breast cancer surgeon from Orange County who has a new book called Prevent, Survive, Thrive, Every Woman's Guide to Optimal Breast Care. And this is an issue that I know you care about, Maria, and I certainly care about it. So let's see if we can get Dr. West on. Are you there, Dr. West?
I am there, yes.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Hi, Michael. Yeah. Hi, Maria.
Dr. West, I was going to say, interestingly enough, I've been a volunteer with the cancer support community in my community, and I facilitate a weekly support group of stage 3 and 4 cancer patients.
Wonderful.
Yeah, interested in hearing what you have to say, because tomorrow's the group and I'm going to share every pearl of wisdom
Cancer survivors are the leaders in the community. Of course, they also need help themselves, and I think having group therapy or group get-together strengthens their resolve, but they're also the leaders in the community in terms of getting information out to their friends and relatives, and I think if we can educate them, that they will carry this message, because there's so much that's going on now and so many exciting new changes that are allowing us the potential to almost get on the verge of curing breast cancer by catching it before it grows. That unfortunately, there's, just like with Michael and people voting in the wrong way, they have government officials saying you don't need to start a mammogram till you're 50. It's crazy. Young women will die needlessly.
Yeah.
Well, and I want to say to that, doctor, that the two reasons that I'm excited to have you on the show is, first, this is a big problem in Washington, D.C., not only politically, but we're one of the top cities in America with breast cancer.
Is that right?
My mother died when I was 15 years old. My father was already gone. She died of breast cancer. My older
Your father
sister
died of breast cancer?
No, my mother.
Oh, your
did.
Mom. Your mom. I misunderstood.
My dad had already passed at that point.
I see.
I was a single mom, and we were poverty stricken. And my older sister took over my life, and she was an amazing woman, a lawyer, first person in my family to go to college. And she died at 46, also of breast cancer. She was diagnosed at 44 with breast cancer. She didn't last very long. But
no, she may have had a genetic situation that maybe should be looked at in your family, because when you get young women diagnosed in their early 40s, you need to check for a BRCA mutation, just like Angelina Jolie had. Those women need a very aggressive follow-up and treatment.
Well, and I understand there's more than that now, too, right? More than the BRCA?
You're absolutely right. And not only is there a lot more, there's almost 50 genes, about 30 of them apply to a breast cancer risk. But the costs have gone down from $4,000 when Angelina Jolie had it done a few years ago to now you can do it for $150. You can do it on the Internet. You don't need a doctor's referral, and it costs you less than a Diet Coke a day for a year. You can pay for your genetic testing. So, and if you know you're negative, that's a tremendous relief. If, in fact, you're positive, you need help, and somebody needs to advise you on what your options are.
Can you tell us, is that available, that information, on your breastcare.com website, the genetic testing via the Internet?
It's just simply, you can write down colorgenomics.com. I think we have a special at $150 through our office. I think the standard price may be $250. I may be giving you private information I shouldn't be sharing. But the point is, any woman who is concerned about it running in her family, because she's got any kind of a family history, or if she's Ashkenazi Jewish descent, should strongly consider genetic testing. And there are two great things about genetic testing. One, if you're negative, you can relax. You know everything's okay. You're not carrying the gene. If it's positive, you know you need help. And so it's just a tremendous breakthrough that's just happened in the last few years. And doctors, most doctors don't know about this. Just like breast density and when to start mammograms and when to do an ultrasound, the primary care doctors now are so busy, they spend so much time on the computer, things have gotten so complex that they basically throw up their hands and say, you know, all I have to do is run people through like cattle because I can't stand practice unless I have a high volume, and I cannot provide the kind of care I want unless you have some kind of a concierge doctor, and most people just can't afford that.
Well, doctor, you know, I listened to one of your videos online, and I was astounded by some of the things you had to say, and I think that, you know, this idea that we should start this at 50. I think you make such a strong argument that it should be at 40 instead of 50. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Talk about the randomized studies that this
misinformation
is based
on. Yes, well, of course, when we want to find out if something works or doesn't work, the key is a randomized study. And the key to a randomized study is you work such that the people are divided into two groups and totally arm's length decision. So if you take everybody who has a social security number that ends in an even number, they might go in group A, and if they have an odd social security number, group B. Well, the study that was done in Canada, and they spent $25 million on this, and they had a bias going into it that we were doing too many mammograms. So what they did, they first randomized the patient, and then they had nurses check every woman and do a physical exam. So guess what? 19 of 21 women with advanced cancer, they shouldn't even have been in the study in the first place, but they went into the mammography studies, and a small percentage of women, most of the women with negative exams went into the no mammogram group. So not surprisingly, in a study that's poorly designed like that, full of flaws, they came up with an erroneous conclusion that 22% of all breast cancers would disappear without treatment. Now think about it. There's never been a case in the history of the United States, in the English-speaking language, in our scientific literature, of a single case of breast cancer disappearing without treatment, and yet the conclusion of this group is that 22% of breast cancers would disappear without treatment. It is so bizarre, it's so misleading, it's so dangerous, it's so reckless that most people just don't, they throw up their hands, they can't believe it. But the good news is, another study very recently out of Canada and another study more recently out of Europe shows that aggressive breast cancer screening starting at age 40 cuts breast cancer mortality in half. And then if we apply the newer, more exciting imaging techniques like 3D mammography and screening ultrasound and MRIs for high-risk women, I think we can cut breast cancer mortality 90% if we can get 100% of the women to follow early detection guidelines.
Well, now, that's amazing.
Several of the participants in my group claimed that they had a mammogram and it wasn't evidence there. Is that the exception?
Exactly the problem. And let me have you ask each and every one of them, did their mammogram show breast density? Because we know that if it's harder to see a cancer in a dense breast, because cancers are basically white, and dense breast, the background is white, so it's like looking for a snowman in a snowstorm. On the other hand, women, the other half of the women who don't have dense breasts have fatty breasts where the background is black. So a white cancer will show up like a light bulb in a dark room. It's easy. It's almost anybody could see it. So what we have learned is that the reason we were, like the women in your group, why we missed most of them, the primary reason was assuming that they were getting yearly mammograms, the primary reason is that most of these women have dense breasts, and for the average risk woman, if you add screening ultrasound to women with women with dense breasts, you double the pickup of small, potentially curable breast cancers. So we have the solution to that problem. The reality is we have a law here in California, and there's multiple states that have the law, but we found in California after 3 years of the law being enacted that less than 1% of the women are notified that they need additional imaging for those women who have dense breasts. So the reality is we have a law, we have scientific findings that it works, but why are these women not being informed? And the reality is the primary care doctors just don't have the time. The answer, the solution, the way you get optimal breast care is you take charge of your breast health. You learn the data. That's what my book tries to supply. It gives women the option to go to their doctor and say, hey, by the way, if my breasts are dense, I want to make sure I get a screening ultrasound. And if you don't want to do it, I'll get somebody who does. And I think women have to simply take charge. They have to know what needs to be done. And if they do that, they have a much higher chance of detecting breast cancer in the earliest stage, needing less aggressive therapy, and having a higher probability of cure.
Well, you know, doctor, I've got to tell you something on that particular point as part of my experience. When I went through the whole thing with my sister, one thing that I remember is that, for example, they told her how important her attitude was and to have a positive attitude. And when she went in for her first round of chemotherapy, they put her in a room with two women that were in the final stages. They were just and they just looked terrible. And I said to the doctor, if attitude is so important, why do you put, you know, somebody in the finals? And they said, well, there's no other place to put them. So I realized at that point, that was very early on in treatment, that she needed an advocate every step of the way. And I tried to be that advocate for her. And so I think such an important point that you make, that women have to take charge of this and they have to be their own advocates.
Absolutely. And it'll save lives. And in the long run, that's how we detect cancer at the earliest stage and give women the highest probability for a cure.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that I've seen with my group is not only what you just said, Michael, is about attitude, but clinical trials and second and third opinions.
You're so right. And if you look at the data, it's frightening. And the Komen Foundation has looked at this. The American College of Pathology has looked at this. And they found that about 3% of the invasive cancers are misdiagnosed. So it's always worth particularly sending your slides out. But more importantly, for the women with non-invasive cancer, there's about a 25% miss rate. So women are either overtreated or undertreated. So it's very inexpensive to get a second opinion on your slides. There's also it's important to find a comprehensive breast center where people focus exclusively on breast cancer care, and they have imagers and surgeons and oncologists and radiation therapists and support services, nutritional services, all the things that are necessary to give the patient the right kind of information and to take care of them as patients. But I think your point is really well taken, that some of these places are so busy they have patients out in the halls getting IVs and chemotherapy, and at some point maybe it's better to drive a little bit farther to get to a university or a place that really specializes in breast cancer care.
Again, doctor, let me just say that was my experience too. My sister was neutropenic, and they put her in a room with a woman that had a communicable disease. And when we questioned them about it, they said, well, what do you want us to do, put her in the hall? And I said, yes, if that's what you have to do to keep her away from this person, put her in the hall. And that's what they did. They put her in the hall.
That's just the most amazing story. It's almost unbelievable. The reality is I hear stories like this all the time. I belong to a group, the American Society of Breast Surgeons, and we have the book tells women how to get a hold of surgeons in their area, but we have about 3,000 breast surgeon specialists, and if you contact one of them in your area, I think it's much more likely you'll get the kind of comprehensive care that you need, as opposed to something where they put you in the same room as somebody with an infectious disease when you're leukopenic. That's just almost malpractice. It is malpractice.
Yeah. Well, and that person had meningitis.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God.
So, Dr. West, can you walk our listeners through what, because I understand once the C diagnosis comes out, people stop processing information. And if, like what the senator is suggesting, they don't have an advocate there, all they see is lips moving and words just, it's a, the word salad, basically.
That's a really good point. One of the things, of course, I'm prejudiced on this, but I know on my book I have a chapter on just diagnosed. And it runs through it from A to Z, and it lists about 20 major key questions. You can only ask so many. But you don't need to ask all of them. You need to look at your case and ask those questions that are important to you. And you need to start kind of slowly. You have to have a physician that will listen to you and take the time to answer your questions, that has the ability to explain what's ahead of you, that has the ability to understand how much you can understand at that particular point in time. And unfortunately, a lot of care is given by people that are general surgeons or that are doing gallbladders and hernias, and they're so busy and they don't have time to do this. We're fortunate in our situation where we all specialize in this, and I can have a patient come in with a very poor prognosis. I'll have my oncologist come in. I'll have the survivors come in. I'll have the nurses come in, and maybe that's more information than she needs, but they can list exactly what the proposed treatment plan is and say, here's how we'll walk you through step by step. Don't expect to remember everything the first time around. We'll list the 10 important things that you need to know. We'll give you our backline phone number. I'll give them my cell number, and I'll say, call us. If it's on the weekend, call me. But if you have a question that's not answered within less than one day, that's stressful. You need answers for your question. But you need an organized approach, because, and that's why I think the book condenses it into one chapter, because by hearing from a breast surgeon who's been doing it for 40 years and taken care of tens of thousands of patients, I've figured out what seems to me to be the ideal step-by-step approach to answering questions, pushing your arm around your patients, giving them a hug, and say, don't worry, we're a team. I'm going to get you through this. And if you have a question anytime, day or night, you call me.
Wow. Well, you know, doctor, I once gave a speech on this about my sister and my mom before a bunch of doctors, and you know, just to put a kind of humanize it a little bit. And we talked about patient navigators. That was the big thing. This is about 5 years ago, and that was the thing that they were really trying to get across, that people should have patient navigators. What do you think about that? And do we have those people? I mean, obviously you do that, but do we have people that specialize in just navigating you through this whole morass of things that you need to do?
We do. Of course, we manage it on our own, and I do it personally, which is helpful but not practical for everybody. So if you have for instance, a big hospital situation where you're screening thousands of patients and one needs a biopsy and it comes back positive, then the imaging department simply calls the patient and says, go find a surgeon. That was released in the old days. Now the nurse navigator can say, here's the surgeons that we know that specialize in breast care. Here's our locations and phone numbers. If you'd like to do it through our hospital system, may have in-house people. But they understand that breast cancer care is a continuum. It starts with self-exam when you're young. It goes to getting mammograms starting at 40. It goes to finding subtle changes and detecting cancer through a core-needle biopsy and then informing the patient that it is positive. And this is what, in big picture, they need to have done. And the next step is to find typically a breast surgeon or a surgeon that specializes in this, because a surgeon is usually the captain of the ship that decides whether the patient needs a lumpectomy plus radiation or a mastectomy, mm-hmm. or it works with a plastic surgeon where they can do a mastectomy and reconstruction. Or in patients with very large breasts, we typically do a wide lumpectomy, and then we reduce that breast and then match the other breast. So the woman, after she recovers, looks better. I've had women say, I haven't looked this good in the last 20 years, because they have a youthful contour when we get done, and we get much wider margins around our tumor. So I think the nurse navigator is a great idea, and I think for those hospitals that have multiple surgeons, that at least one nurse navigator is sort of the buck stops here. We've obviated that problem by having a back office that's all they do. We work with them daily, and so the patient can call the office and get an answer almost immediately. If I'm in surgery, of course, they take the number and I call them back. If it's on the weekend, they just call me on their cell phones. And I can tell you, patients are very respectful. My colleagues say, that's crazy. What are you doing that for? I've only 30 years I've been doing this, one call at night that was, I'd say, probably wasn't needed. The rest of the calls are so respectful. They have very thought-out questions. They say, hey, doc, I've been talking to my husband. He understood this. I understand that. It's Friday afternoon. I don't want to go through the weekend worrying about this. So it's easy for me to answer. Of course I can answer. If I can't give them an answer that really resonates and makes them feel confident, just see me Monday morning. I'll squeeze you in. But we need to talk about this. You can't go on unless that's a stop point. Once you have an unanswered question, you feel uncomfortable to move on. So it means you have to rethink things out and not just answer the question, but what does the answer mean? What does that mean down the line? What are your choices? How do you pick one choice, lumpectomy, or how do you decide on mastectomy? What do you do about doing a sentinel lymph node or doing all the lymph nodes? Do you need to see an oncologist first and get chemo first? Do you need to see a plastic surgeon? Are you under stress? Do you need to work with our volunteer service? You know, there's just so many things that can be done when you have all the proper resources. And I think we're blessed because we put this whole package together, and we can manage it and make sure that we get the best possible care and get feedback from our patients and let them know when we're doing a good job, and let them know when we need help. And most of the time we get great, great reviews because it is so organized.
What about the psychosocial aspect of it?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
The psychosocial aspect of the labyrinth that they're going down, like the support groups that I'm involved with or the one-on-one short-term counseling. Do you have an adjunct to your services in that regard?
We never, I would say never, but 99% of the time when we go in with a patient to discuss her diagnosis, we have a survivor that's at least 1 year out and has been specifically trained, particularly not to provide medical information, but redirect medical questions back to the doctors. Then, if, for instance, we have a young patient and an older volunteer, we try to match for a patient that's the same age, that has the same type of tumor, if they're going to have chemotherapy, a woman that's had chemotherapy. So we can really, the volunteers sometimes will spend hours with patients. They'll sometimes go to their house to discuss it, but it makes it so much easier when the patients are comforted, when the patients feel confident, when they feel like their questions have been addressed, when they feel they can go to a doctor that's knowledgeable or a support service that really knows what they're doing. And of course, we have a counselor that's specifically trained in counseling and who is an expert in breast or cancer counseling. And she's there as a resource for people who have more complex needs.
Nice.
Yeah, and I think that's so important because what you say, I'm sorry, Marie, but to interrupt, but many people that I know, women that I knew who got breast cancer would come to me because they knew of my history with my sister. My sister was single and I went through every step of the way with her, but I had a hard time talking to them about it because in Pat's case and in my mom's case, you know, they both passed away and I felt like didn't want to, you know, say that the final, you know, I didn't want to depress them with that. Yeah. So I had
that's,
a hard
that's
time.
That's a real good point. And I think that's why we match the volunteers to somebody that has the symptoms. So if somebody comes in with 10 positive lymph nodes that you can see on the mammogram, then we're going to match them up with somebody who presented with a locally advanced cancer that underwent aggressive chemotherapy and is a survivor, because that's really important. You make a great point there, because it is very important. One whole chapter is on the importance of hope, and I talk about two women who were told to fill out their will. There was nothing their doctors could do for them. And both of them came to us. We put both of them on clinical trials. We provided some very modern chemotherapeutic agents, and both of them survived. One of them now was diagnosed 35 years ago. She was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was 32. She had no lymph nodes. They just did a mastectomy. They put her on they did not even use chemo. But they had her come back in a year, and she had a chest x-ray before she came in. The chest x-ray showed she was full of metastasis to her lungs. So the doctor said, we're going to put you on chemo. She said, well, will that take care of it? Will I be all right? And he said, you have 6 months to live. You're going to have to fill out a will. And she couldn't believe it. And she went home. She was a single. She had no resources. She finally, after a few weeks, she went to a bookstore and found a book titled I am a Cancer Survivor. And she looked up of several chapters, and there was a lady that survived breast cancer for 10 years. She says, well, if she can do it, I can do it. And that really turned her around. And she turned out she was BRCA1. She carried the gene. She ended up with cancer on the other side. She's had bilateral reconstruction. And now every time I get a patient who has a very poor prognosis, I have Barbara Scott give her a call. She's a professional counselor. She spends a great deal of time, and it gives the women hope. Hope is so important, and there is always hope.
Nobody can hear me.
Okay, let's put our caller on. We have a caller, doctor, that has a question. So
great.
Let's see what they have to say. Hi, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. Hi. First, let me thank you, doctor. You, Senator Brown, and Maria for your work, as always. But, doctor, did you say the study that you mentioned, was that done in Canada?
Yes, it was. It was, we call it the first Canadian study. Dr. Miller was a chief author of the paper.
Dr. Miller, well, have you ever heard of a guy, Rick Simpson, I think his name is? I think he has some type of, might be a documentary, a run from the cure in Canada.
Oh, interesting.
Well, I know that there's some Canadian surgeons that have done more modern studies that showed a 40% survival rate. This is using old technology for women with breast cancer, and so that report pretty much negated the initial report. But I'm not sure of the. I know of the person you're talking. I'm not sure I quite understand what it is.
Well, I think he deals. He's with the marijuana cure. I understand it. Yeah, I understand he had great success somehow with certain, I guess it's a THC, I'm not sure what it is.
CBD.
Yeah, I think for patients with pain, usually the oncologists are dealing with patients with pain, but we do have a couple of patients that are treated in marijuana clinics, and it's available to our patients. Most of our patients can be controlled without it, but you never overlook a resource. But I'm not sure of any studies that have been done in terms of cancer pain or breast cancer care.
What is the name of your book? And that's the last question.
It's Prevent. Thank you for asking. Prevent, Survive, Thrive, Every Woman's Guide to Optimal Breast Care.
Prevent, Survive, Every Woman's...
Prevent, Survive, Thrive is basically the title. Those three words. Thrive. Prevent, Survive, Thrive. And the tagline is Every Woman's Guide to Optimal Breast Care.
Okay. I guess men could use that too, though, right?
There is a chapter for men, and the thing about men that's very interesting, a lot of young boys or teenagers will have breast lumps, and the key thing there is not to worry about it. They'll typically go away. If they don't, you can consider surgery in that small percentage, but most of the time they go away. Men between 20 and 40, when they get breast lumps, we worry about testicular cancer, and so we have to screen all those women for testicular, all those men for testicular, and that can be done with some serum or some blood tests. And then for men that are 40 and over, when they get lumps, then we have to start thinking about breast cancer, particularly the older ones. The reality is, in men, it's quite easy to do an ultrasound to determine something is irregular, to put a needle into it, make the diagnosis. Usually we can do that in a day or two from the time we see men. But most men who have lumps are not cancer. Most of them are benign.
So along those lines, Dr. West, thank you, Taboo. My eldest son had a mastectomy at 22, and then he had a lumpectomy at 30. He's now 32.
This is for gynecomastia?
Yes.
Male breast enlargement?
Yes.
Not cancer.
So the first one they said was cancer because of the mastectomy, and then the second one they diagnosed what you just said.
That is an amazing story. That's the youngest male. I'd really like to get the past report on that. I've never heard of a male in that age group having cancer. And I would strongly suspect he carries a mutation. When men get cancer, they're much more likely to carry the BRCA mutation than a woman, because in the female side, women who carry the gene typically get breast cancer, at least 80-5% of them do. But men oftentimes will carry the gene but not have the cancer. We had a 43-year-old patient that showed up on our clinic a few years back. Any woman under 45 who has breast cancer, we automatically do gene testing. She tested positive, and we couldn't believe it because she had zero family history. After a thorough investigation, we found out that her great-grandfather had breast cancer, who passed it on to her grandfather, who passed it on to her father, who passed it on to her. So even though you may think it doesn't run in your family, as was the case in this patient, it can run in the family, but be silent. And so it's very important to be aware of that.
So because my mother had breast cancer, she had a mastectomy 10 and a half years ago, and she's still alive. So he's obviously a strong proponent for what you were just talking about. Was it the color genomics?
Color genomics is a less expensive one, but in your case, you could go directly to your insurance. You would qualify for any of the Myriad, or they have several different companies that do this. And if you meet criteria, this is established by the NCCN, which is the body that makes most of the rules on oncology and on surgery and on breast care. The insurance is required to pay, so you definitely should undergo genetic testing.
Me too?
Yeah, absolutely, because you're at risk for both. If you don't have it, you can relax. If you do have the gene, you know, you can have your mother still alive?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if she tested negative, then you wouldn't have to worry.
She doesn't share.
Yeah. Well, then you should test it, because she probably has a pretty high, from what you're saying, with having a son that had it, your brother,
that is
a major, major, in fact, I want you to call me back on this. I am very interested in what you're telling me.
Okay. Thank you.
And since you mentioned insurance companies, doctor, let's talk about them for a minute. Can you tell us what the U.S. Prevention Task Force is and tell us what you think? I got the impression that they stand in the way and they're supported by insurance companies.
I suspect that is the case. I can't prove it, but this is a group of primary care doctors who were appointed with the goal of providing other primary care doctors guidelines on cancer care. And they came in with a major bias that we are, by and large, doing too much. So let me give you two examples of what they've... this is the same group that said pap smears every 3 years. They also have said, for men, don't start your PSA testing at 40, start it at 50. Well, here's what happened. Now we're seeing, after 10 years, a drastic increase in men with advanced prostate cancer. Those men who had early onset prostate cancer in their 40s or mid-40s, this cancer didn't go away. It continued to progress. So rather than catch it at stage one, they're catching it stage three or four. The chances of surviving stage three or four are much smaller than surviving stage one. So this is a bias that's come back to bite them. And they're not willing to admit this, but the same thing, they're saying start breast cancer screening at age 50 based on this erroneous study. But here's what's going to happen. 22% of the cancers will never disappear. A large percentage of these early cancers that are diagnosed at stage 0 or stage 1 in the 40s will be stage 3 or stage 4 by the time they're diagnosed in their 50s. The cost of care for an early breast cancer is a lifetime cost is about $50,000. The cost of treating a woman with advanced breast cancer with all the chemotherapy and the immunotherapy drugs can easily run way over $1 million, and many of those women won't make it. The key to saving money and saving lives and saving suffering and maintaining families, the mother of the family, all these things are so critical, and it saves money by starting screening at age 40. More years of life are lost for women in their 40s than for all the years of life lost for women 50 and over from breast cancer. So catching it early saves lives, saves money, saves suffering.
And doctor, because Taboo, our caller, was asking you about the book, do you want to talk about your petition too that you're circulating?
Well, yes. Here's the issue about the petition. There's an issue of breast density that I alluded to before, and let me just start give you kind of an overview to start with. About half of the women, if you look at their breast pattern, they have more than 50% of the breast pattern is made up of dense tissue, both glandular and supportive tissue. These breasts look white, and so if a cancer is white and there's a background is white, it's very hard sometimes to detect a cancer, whereas women with fatty breasts, the other half, it's really easy to see it because it shows up as a white spot with a black background, so it's quite simple. So we have learned, and probably the person that's really made this go public is Nancy Capello, and let me briefly tell you her story. She's a lawyer from New York. She started her yearly screening at age 40. She was compulsive. She did it until she was age 53. I think she did it like on a January, and then in March, she feels a lump. They do an ultrasound. The mass is big. She ends up with a mastectomy. She had 12 positive lymph nodes. She goes back to her doctors and says, hey, what happened? You let me down. I did everything you told me to do, and I have an advanced cancer, and I have a higher chance of not surviving, and I have to have aggressive chemotherapy. And they said, well, your breasts were dense. It was hard to see. And she said, well, wait a minute. Nobody told me my breasts were dense. Well, she's gone out and state after state and got them to enact laws, as in California, very similar in New York and other states, saying that the doctor who orders the mammogram, if it comes back showing breast density, is by law required to tell the woman that her breasts are dense, the mammogram may miss a cancer, and that there are things that can be done to identify that cancer. And in short, it's ultrasound screening for women at average risk and MRI screening for women who are at high risk. The tragedy, the overwhelming tragedy, particularly in California, but many other states, is the primary care doctors, the ordering physicians, don't understand this law. They don't understand breast density. They don't talk to the patients. So in Orange County, California, as in many other states, less than 1 in 100 women are even informed that their breasts are dense, let alone being informed of what that means and what to do about it. So we started a petition, 40, not 50, in part to deal with the density problem and in part to promote the concept of starting screening at age 40. So if women want to sign our 40 Not 50 campaign, they can go to the internet, look at our website, 40not50.org. They can learn a lot more about this. They can sign up, and they can then send an email to their friends to also sign up. But we need 1 million signatures to really commit to convince the government to make the guidelines say that the insurance companies don't have to pay till they're 50. The other issue that we deal with is the issue of breast density, and women simply need to be informed. So we have another website, breastdensity.org, where women can go and learn about the importance and learn to ask. See, the woman must be empowered to ask. She must tell the doctor, A, I want to start yearly at 40. B, if my breasts are dense, I want you to tell me that I need extra imaging and what to do and order it for me. And if you don't, I'll find somebody who will. Now, one of the things we alluded to here is some women are just average risk with dense breasts. They just need a screening ultrasound, and that doubles the pickup of small cancers. But for you, because of your family history, if your breasts are dense, a 50-50 chance they are, you should have a screening MRI. So even if you test negative for the BRCA gene, with your high-risk situation, a brother and a mother, you should be in a high-risk screening clinic, and you should at least have a baseline MRI, even if your breasts aren't dense. So it's really critical to learn this information. The condensed way to get all of this information is in the book, but the websites will provide a lot of information, and those are available to everybody.
So I had the 3D one in December. Does that help?
Yes, the 3D is a real step forward, and it really has made life easier for women, because one of the worst things that can happen when you go in for your yearly mammogram is that you get a letter that the mammogram was abnormal, and you have to come back for additional imaging. And this happens primarily, when women with dense breasts. The 3D mammogram gives better resolution. They can see these small cancers that are hiding in the dense breast, so they can do the entire workup on the first visit so that women don't have a much lower chance of being called back. And it detects cancers that they wouldn't know that the woman had. So my wife is a great example of that. She has dense breasts. She has some family history. She got a 3D mammogram the last 3 years in a row. Last year, it showed a little bitty 6-millimeter spot in one view of the 3D mammogram. They worked it up. She ended up having a low-grade lobular cancer that just required a lumpectomy and radiation. And now she's on some hormone-blocking pills. But no mastectomy, no great major surgery. Everything, by catching it early, her probability of survival is the same as almost anybody else's. It should be a cure.
So to the radiologist, sorry, Michael, to give the dense diagnosis rather than the primary care physician?
The radiologist by law is required to send out a report. Radiologists really don't like talking to people. Their job is to read and read efficiently and read in high volume. It's the doctor's responsibility, actually. It's a primary care doctor. That's the way the law is written. Now, I would be in favor of a law that said that the imaging department should get much more specific about this and maybe even have somebody call them and explain it. But realize this is half of their patients. So if they're seeing 30,000 patients in a month, then they have to make 15,000 calls. And believe me, once you make these calls, they can go on and on with questions. And so it just isn't very practical.
Well, let me say that, one thing that's absolutely true in politics is that the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So if you're out there listening, please go to the doctor's website and sign the petition. Because if you get the million signatures, yeah, I guarantee you, you'll get the politician's attention. That doesn't necessarily mean they'll do anything, but at least they will take notice. And let me also say,
you're absolutely right. This is a step in the right direction. We're looking for help, and maybe you have some people you can direct me to talk to them. But it should have been voted on last year, but they fortunately got it postponed till next year. But we don't have a lot of time, and we don't have enough signatures to convince anybody yet. So again, 40not50.org. Sign the petition. Read the information. Look at the videos, and make sure if you sign that you also get your friends to sign. It's important that we get the word out.
Well, and let me also say, Valentine's Day is next week, and when you give your loved one a box of candy or a dozen roses, make sure you include a copy of the doctor's book. Because I think it's really important that I really agree with you, Doctor. Women have to take on this responsibility and push for it. We see politically that there's a new coming of age through the Me Too movement and other things that are empowering women. So, if you care about the woman in your life, make sure they read this book. I would think it's the best thing you could do for them.
Well, actually, regardless of gender or sexual orientation or identity, every human being has breasts.
Yes, that's right.
That's right. That's right. And for those transgender patients that are taking hormones or particularly estrogen, they probably are at risk and should be particularly vigilant doing self-exam, but to follow the same rules on mammography. And if they are at high risk because of a family history, they should undergo high-risk counseling.
Well, thank you for being with us tonight, Doctor. We so appreciate this. And you've given us a lot to think about. And I hope you'll come back soon so we can talk more about this, because it's so important for the women in our lives to be protected.
So one more question. When is the deadline for the petition? Because I'll most definitely share it tomorrow with my survivors group.
Yeah, I think it goes into 2019, and I don't know whether it's June or December. that it ends. But it does have an end date, and if something isn't done, it will be automatically enacted. So I don't know exactly what the date is, but I know we're free for the end of this year, and it may be the January 1st, 2019, that it, I think, is when it expires.
But that's what I wanted to share, is that there is an urgency here, because
it is
time sensitive.
There is an absolute urgency, because, you know, it takes time to build a movement like this up, and in the early phase, it's like, you know, pushing that log up the hill. There's just a lot of, you know, people are busy, and there's so many conflicting things going on. But once we reach a certain amount of momentum, I think we can get our 1 million signatures, maybe 2 million signatures. I think this is a grassroots movement that can make a major difference in women's lives. It can save lives. The public, by and large, can take charge of their health, and men can sign this thing too, and they should take care of their wives, and every woman, whether they buy the book or not, everybody listening, at least go to that website, go to 40not50.org, sign the petition, and the big picture, this may be the best way you can save women's lives.
Well, on that note, Doctor, thank you very much, and we'll have you back soon.
I hope so.
And your passion is palpable.
Yes, it really is.
I do feel strongly about this, and I do feel strongly about my patient. Nothing is worse than a situation where a woman's had a delayed diagnosis, particularly if it was because somebody didn't give her the right information. And so we see that all too often.
Well, thanks again, Doctor.
And continued success. Really appreciate that.
Yes, very much.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. I hope to come back again.
That would
be
great.
We'll
Thank
you
so
again.
Much. I'm signing the petition as soon as we log off.
Yeah, me too. And let me end the show on this note, Maria.
Yes,
today
sir.
Is my wife's birthday. So
Yay!
Happy birthday, Patty. She's a dedicated listener. Why she took an interest in me, I'll never know. But she is without a doubt the luckiest break I've ever gotten in life. Uh-huh. So happy birthday, honey. I hope it's a great day. And
what did you do to help make that so?
Well, I took her out to dinner last night.
Okay.
Then I took her to breakfast this morning.
Nice.
Our favorite greasy spoon. And then I bought her a computer. That was her birthday present. It was her laptop moves at you know, it's prehistoric at this point because it's 5 or 6 years old. So we went to the Apple store and got her a new one. So she's got a new toy to play with.
Nice.
So that was it. And now we're going to have dinner happy
Give
birthday, Patty.
Best.
Okay, thanks, Maria, and we'll see you next week. And we're going to leave you with a classic song from Gloria Gaynor. And we'll see you next week, folks.
At first I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. But now you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 100 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.